Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
It's December of the year 494, and there's a strong chill in the morning air. It'll warm up over the course of the day, but for now, there's a thin rime of frost covering the worn flagstones of the Roman Forum. A courier rides into the city, his horse stepping carefully over the ancient pavement. Rome's streets are empty. Trees, their branches bare of leaves in the icy December sunlight, poke through the ruined roofs of empty houses and taverns. Deserted apartment buildings, five stories tall, cast long, mournful shadows over the cramped, narrow streets. The smell of raw sewage wafts out of plumbing clogged from centuries of ordure. There are no workers left to clean them or public funds to pay the workers. The vast edifices of grand baths, temples, and the Colosseum still stand proud, jutting up to the sky, but people are only rarely to be seen. The occasional stray dog skitters out of the way of the courier and his tired, overworked horse. The memories of Rome's past glory are all around, haunting the empty streets. The courier finds no greeting and meets no one as he arrives. It's just as well. He's very tired, exhausted down to the bone. It had been a fast, punishing journey, taking just 2 days to cover the 220 miles from Ravenna, the capital, to Rome. His red cloak is stained with the dust and mud of the late fall trip. The effort of holding on to his galloping horse has chafed his legs raw and bloody. He carries letters from Theodoric, the king of the Goths, the new ruler of Italy. The courier's job is to deliver them to the Senate of Rome. These days, the senators don't have much power. It's more a club for self-important aristocrats than a policy-making body. The courier isn't impressed with these supposedly great men as he delivers his letters and collects one in return to take back to Ravenna. A century before, Rome had been filled to bursting with the hum and vibration of commerce and culture. Nearly a million people had crammed into its sky-high apartments, bustling markets, basilicas, bathhouses, and rich temples and churches. Now, perhaps only 100,000 people live amid the decaying ruins of a once great empire. What had been the greatest city in the world is nothing but a shadow of its former self. All over the western half of what had been the Roman Empire, cities were emptying. Aqueducts and sewers were left untended. Ports silted up and became unusable. Docks decayed and roads weren't repaired. Arenas were turned into apartments. Bathhouses and temples crumbled into disrepair. Grand townhouses, the homes of generations of cultured aristocrats, were abandoned. A dense network of thriving urban centers disappeared, and with it, a whole way of life. On today's episode, The Decline and Fall of the Roman City, I'll tell you how we got there. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me. In our last episode, we talked at length about how cities made the Roman world Roman. They're what come to mind when we think about the Roman Empire. Temples, baths, palaces, the Forum, arenas, triumphal arches, aqueducts, impressive marble ruins reaching for the sky. They weren't just reflections of Rome, but active pieces that created what it meant to think and act like a Roman. Rome itself was just one of hundreds of cities in the Roman Empire. There were the Mediterranean megalopolises like Rome, Carthage, Alexandria, and Constantinople, the New Rome. There were the regional cities like Milan in Italy, Marseille in Gaul, London in Britain, Athens in Greece, and Tarragona in Spain. And finally, there were hundreds of smaller cities scattered along the roads, rivers, and coasts of the Roman Empire. In terms of how the Romans thought about themselves, how they structured their empire politically, and how their economy functioned, the Roman Empire was an empire of cities. cities were an expression of how the Romans understood and organized their world. Making newly conquered regions like Spain, Gaul, and Britain Roman involved building cities and pulling the most important people in those places into the cities. Only then could they really be Roman. Cities were administrative centers. Each one, each civitas, as the Romans called them, was responsible for the surrounding rural territory. More specifically, the most important people in those places were responsible for administration. These aristocrats assessed and collected taxes, they built and maintained infrastructure, and they guaranteed the grain supply for their home city. Rural estates that produced valuable grain, wine, oil, and whatnot made these aristocrats wealthy, but their home city was where they went to play politics and spend their money. It was the civic duty of these aristocrats to compete for seats on the city council, the curia, and do the kind of administrative work that we've talked about. They were supposed to give back to the city in the form of donating temples, baths, aqueducts, and the like. This was a really powerful ideology, what scholars call civic avergitism. For an aristocrat to be worthwhile, to have an identity, to matter, he had to participate in civic life. That was a big part of what it meant to be Roman. As long as aristocrats were doing these jobs and spending their money in cities, that went a long way toward ensuring they prospered. But cities weren't just playgrounds for the idle rich, consumer cities that wasted valuable resources produced in the countryside. Instead, they were essential cornerstones of the Roman economy. What defined the Roman economy, as opposed to what came before and after, was the mass movement of low-value bulk goods. Things like grain, olive oil, wine, fish sauce, textiles, and ceramics are all pretty cheap on a per-unit basis. To make money off bulk goods, you have to trade them in enormous quantities. Now, this sounds pretty normal to us. We live in a hyper-connected world where global trade is just background noise. We get wine from California or France, bananas from the Caribbean, and wheat from Iowa without thinking twice about it. But in the pre-modern world, that wasn't the case. You need a highly developed infrastructure of ports, canals, and roads to move lots of bulk goods from place to place. For commercial markets to function, you need a constant stream of information about prices. Most of all, you need cities with easy access to all of those land and water routes to act as transshipment points. You can't connect every point on the map to every other point. You need cities to be nodes in trade networks where you can gather up goods, ship them, and then distribute them. You need places where reliable information can travel quickly. This network of Roman cities that connected the entire Mediterranean world and beyond is what powered the complex, advanced Roman economy, one that looks so much like our own. Beyond local administration, cities needed the Roman state to exist. In a direct sense, the state helped with or paid entirely for the construction and upkeep of vital infrastructure. The state provided free or subsidized grain to feed the biggest cities, especially Rome. It stimulated production of staple goods, and its demand for those goods produced economies of scale that made those staples cheaper for private commercial markets. Indirectly, the state guaranteed the money supply. You couldn't have enormous, hyperdense cities without a reliably monetized economy. The state also provided a framework for contract law, a necessity in any commercial economy. Most of all, though, the state provided security and stability. Merchants didn't have to worry much about pirates taking their ships or marauding barbarians attacking them on the roads. Productive rural estates weren't in danger of being sacked and burned to the ground. All of this meant transaction costs were low, which kept the whole machine running smoothly. For the first 2 centuries AD, this system of cities was at its peak in wealth and population, and so was the Roman Empire. We call this the Pax Romana, or the High Empire. But that didn't last forever. The Pax Romana gave way to the crisis of the 3rd century, a 50-year meltdown between 235 and 284 that nearly ended the Roman Empire. the Roman Empire that emerged from the crisis of the 3rd century was much different than what had come before. Where the High Empire of Marcus Aurelius, say, had been run with a remarkably small central government, just a few hundred officials around the emperor, this new late empire of Diocletian and Constantine was much more centralized and authoritarian. The military expanded, and so did the bureaucracy, with tens of thousands of new civil servants now exercising tight control over the provinces. To pay for its military and civil apparatus, the empire collected more taxes and controlled affairs much more tightly. In these new conditions, the cities of the Roman Empire suffered. They didn't disappear overnight. They adapted to less prosperous and stable conditions over the course of centuries. But this was the beginning of the decline that led to their eventual slide into irrelevance.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So let's break down how and why Roman cities started to slide downhill in the 3rd century AD. What exactly do we mean when we talk about the decline of these cities? What caused this decline, and what effects did it have for the people living there? Between 235 and 284, a whole array of disasters struck the Roman Empire. First, a series of epidemics killed a large number of people over the course of the 2nd and 3rd centuries. The Roman Empire's population peaked around 150, and by 300, it may have been 20% less or even more than it had been. That's a lot of people who weren't working or consuming goods anymore, and they weren't living in cities. Second, marauding barbarians struck Britain, Gaul, and the Balkans over and over again. Alemanni, Franks, Saxons, and Goths, to name a few, all sacked cities and disrupted trade and agriculture. Third, imperial politics were a mess. Few emperors lasted more than a couple of years, and usurpations were common. Finally, as a result of all this and more, the economy was a mess. Where there had once been major surpluses to spend on games and public monuments, that money just wasn't around anymore. Cities had to cope with that new environment. They built walls instead of arenas, and those walls surrounded much smaller areas than the cities had occupied at their peak. Let's take Gaul as an example. The new walls of Bordeaux enclosed only 32 hectares, about a quarter of the old city at its peak. The walls of Lyon enclosed 21 hectares versus 65 in the early empire. Autun's new walls enclosed only 12 hectares. The old city had occupied 180. Even if folks were still living outside the walls, cities held far fewer people than they had at the peak of the High Empire. Inhabitants quarried old monuments for stone and marble to use in new constructions. Historians and archaeologists call this the end of quote-unquote monumentality. Cities had been defined by big, fancy public buildings. That was no longer the case. It's an obvious visual sign of the decline we're talking about. As the decentralized early empire gave way to the centralized late empire, the tight bonds between local elites and their cities started to fray. More and more administration was handled by the central government rather than delegated to local authorities. This meant there were fewer inducements for these aristocrats to serve on city councils. The whole thing just amounted to a lot of out-of-pocket cost without the prestige and civic pride that made it worthwhile for them to spend their money on public buildings or entertainment for the masses. They had always had rural estates. In the 4th and 5th centuries, formerly urban aristocrats started to spend more and more time at their country houses, their villas, instead of doing business in towns and cities. At just this time, we see a huge boom in the number, size, and opulence of rural villas in the 4th and 5th centuries all over the western provinces of the empire. Aristocrats constructed fancy new country homes with mosaics and built-in baths with heated floors. Cities had always depended on the consumption of elites to pull money into their communities, along with their donations in the form of public buildings, infrastructure, and guaranteeing the grain supply. That money increasingly stayed in the countryside instead of going to cities. Trying to get these elites to come to town and do their jobs on the city council would be an ongoing struggle for centuries. Around 465, the Gallic aristocrat Sidonius Apollinaris wrote to a certain pastor, quote, "Your absence from yesterday's business of the municipal council is thought by most to have been intentional. They suspect that you wished to avoid the burden of an embassy which might be laid upon your shoulders. I congratulate you on being so eligible a person as to live in constant fear of being elected." You can sense the sarcasm here, right? Imagine 1,000 pastors quietly deciding not to go to the city council meeting and take up some urgent bit of city business, and you can see how the whole apparatus of running a city could fall apart. Decline went deeper than civic disengagement, though. I talked earlier about how the massive trade in bulk goods built on this network of interconnected cities was what made the Roman economy so special. But that was also a pretty fragile system. The fact that you're shipping large quantities of low-value goods means that you depend on low transaction costs and low risk. Smaller markets and more risk threatened that economic system, which created a feedback loop of economic issues for cities that depended for their existence on access to those low-value goods. Constant debasement of the coinage didn't help either, since the whole system required money to function. Now, the crisis of the 3rd century was brutal, but it wasn't a death sentence for Roman cities. The 4th century that followed was actually one of great prosperity throughout the Roman Empire. Some really smart historians argue that the 4th century was actually the empire's peak in terms of bulk trade between regions. I'm pretty convinced. Amid that general prosperity, cities mostly recovered and adapted to the new conditions. A succession of emperors introduced a new monetary system based around the gold solidus. It was stable, and the fact that there was a ton of copper coinage in circulation helped even out-of-the-way towns participate more fully in the money economy. The new tax system was more extensive and more centrally controlled, but its exceptionally high demand stimulated rural production of grain, oil, and other goods. By doing that, it helped to create economies of scale that benefited commercial markets. How do we know all this? People really didn't write about it much, any more than we think about where exactly in the world a loaf of bread comes from. What tells us about this whole complex, interconnected web of cities and trade is pottery. More specifically, it's little pieces of amphorae, the ceramic shipping containers that held oil, wine, and fish sauce, along with the kind of ceramic tableware that everyday people used to eat and drink. Pottery survives in huge quantities. Because there's so much of it, archaeologists can create really detailed models of when and where it comes from. Since pottery had to move from place to place, it's a great proxy marker for trade networks. When we look at the whole big picture, what we see is a vibrant commercial economy with huge amounts of trade pretty much everywhere throughout the 4th century. But there's no getting around the fact that cities weren't the same as they had been before the crisis. They held far fewer people. They were building fewer big, impressive arenas, temples, baths, and other public buildings. Their new walls were imposing and ready to repel invading barbarians. Aristocrats were choosing to endow and build churches rather than grand public works. Bishops were beginning to make their influence felt as civic officials, taking the place of the city councils that had run for centuries. The landscape and the character of the city were in the process of a massive change. By the beginning of the 5th century, things were starting to go south once and for all. That wasn't happening everywhere, not all at once, and we're going to look at two contrasting examples to show how and why that was the case.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
There was enormous regional diversity in the Roman Empire, and urban life was no exception. Some places, like southern Spain and Italy, to name a couple, were incredibly densely settled. In others, like Britain and northern Gaul, towns and cities were few and far between. One study says that the average distance between towns in Baetica in southern Spain and in Umbria in central Italy was just 13 kilometers. In Britain and Gaul, by contrast, the average distance was 105 kilometers. This meant that urban life, this whole complex of interconnected things that we've talked about, was much more fragile in some regions than in others. So our first example is going to be a market town in Britain. There were dozens of these relatively small settlements with perhaps a few hundred or a thousand inhabitants scattered all over the island. Archaeologists call them secondary centers and tend to treat them separately from cities proper. Now, this town could have been Catterick in the north, Worcester in the center, and Neatham in the south. These market towns were really characteristic of the late Roman economy and late Roman urbanism more generally. They weren't the homes of rich aristocrats. They didn't have tons of big public buildings. They weren't important administrative centers. But they were thriving little pieces of the later Roman Empire, every bit as Roman as the baths of Diocletian or the great Basilica of Constantine. These market towns stand out because of their economic function. Because they were usually located at the junctions of local trade routes where roads and rivers met, they were important centers for local economies. Farmers or estate owners would go there to sell their agricultural products like grain or wool. If you needed everyday pottery to use around your house, you'd buy it from a local potter who worked in that market town. Smiths provided basic finished metalwork and repaired broken items. Small merchants sold on goods from further away, like fancy ceramic tableware from North Africa. In other words, these towns provided necessary goods and services for the surrounding rural area. They were connected to other small towns and bigger urban centers by means of roads and waterways. They were part of the urban network. Now, imagine you're living in one of these British market towns around the year 360. We'll say it's Dorchester-on-Thames, near Oxford, about 50 miles up the River Thames from London. It's a prosperous little place. It rings with the sounds of the smith's hammer, the wheels of carts on pavement rolling, laden with grain from the countryside or fine imported goods, the tramp of a detachment of soldiers stopping by on their way to the next posting. Maybe you're a small-time merchant. You trade in imported goods from the continent. Every month, you either hop in a barge and head downriver or take a cart down the old flagstones of the paved road from Dorchester to London. In the big city, you buy amphorae full of wine imported from Gaul or Spain, and olive oil and fine red pottery all the way from North Africa. You pay for it with silver and copper coins. Back in Dorchester-on-Thames, you set up a stall along the big open square at the center of town. From that spot, you sell your wares to wealthy estate owners who come in from their villas, to the small garrison of soldiers up the road, and to the other townspeople who live in Dorchester. Your life seems pretty stable. You're not rich, but you're doing well enough. Your father did this before you, and you have every reason to think your son will follow you. But things are starting to change. Over the next couple of decades, there are more and more barbarian raids, both from the Picts who lived in the north and the Saxons from across the North Sea. Roman generals stationed in Britain declare themselves emperor and take their soldiers across the English Channel to the continent, never to return. From the highest provincial governors down to local officials, Roman government starts to crumble. The wine, olive oil, and ceramics you used to buy in London aren't around anymore. Even money, coin, is in short supply these days. Without a monetized economy, without imported goods, and without stability and order, towns like Dorchester-on-Thames can't exist. Over the next few decades, people drift out to the countryside or leave Britain entirely. New migrants don't replace them. By 410 or so, by the time you're in old age, there's nobody left in the town you grew up and lived in. It's empty. Another decade or two later, even London, the greatest city of Roman Britain, will be a ghost town. In provinces like Britain or Northern Gaul, which were on the fringe of the Roman world, urbanism was a fragile thing. It depended on the state to pump money into the economy, to guarantee public order, and to stimulate demand for imports and production, which could then be distributed from cities. Market towns were a byproduct of that world, of an artificial, long-distance connection between Northern Europe and the Mediterranean. By the 420s, Roman rule was gone from Britain, and so was that artificial connection. Urbanism left along with it. I can't stress this enough. A century after Dorchester-on-Thames was a thriving market town, there wasn't a single urban unit of any size left in Britain. But that wasn't the case everywhere in the Roman Empire. Britain's connection to the center of the Roman Empire was tenuous, essentially created by the state. In the big cities of the Mediterranean, those connections had already existed for centuries and would continue to exist even after the empire fell apart. Again, let's say you're a merchant. You live in the city of Arles, at the mouth of the Rhone River in southern Gaul. Arles isn't one of the biggest cities in the Roman Empire. It's no Rome, Carthage, Alexandria, or Constantinople. But it's still sizable, with 75,000, even 100,000 people at the beginning of the 5th century. Arles was briefly an imperial capital, and it was the headquarters of a praetorian prefecture, one of the major administrative regions of the Western Empire. In 400, as Dorchester-on-Thames was nearing the end of its existence, Arles was thriving. Because it sat at the mouth of the Rhone River, one of the major routes to inland Gaul, it was the gateway for huge amounts of traffic. All those imported trade goods that we've talked about flowed through the docks of Arles in enormous quantities. If you were a merchant in Arles in 400, the concept of a declining city wouldn't have made any sense to you. You bought wares off the great merchant ships that plied the Mediterranean. Many of these ships were subsidized by the state. the rich region of Africa was taxed in the form of grain and oil, which was destined to feed Rome and maybe the other major cities of Italy. You're talking about feeding more than 1 million people, so you get a sense of the scale involved. The captains of these ships, navicularii, moved those massive quantities of grain and oil from Carthage to Portus or Ostia and had some of their costs underwritten by the state. Once they lived up to their end of the bargain by delivering the grain and oil, those captains could trade privately wherever they wanted, all across the Mediterranean. The biggest beneficiaries of this system were the provinces of Africa and Italy. Africa, because it created economies of scale in the production of agricultural goods, and it lowered transaction costs for other goods produced there like pottery. And, of course, Italy, because it was basically benefiting from redistribution on a huge scale. But other Mediterranean cities like Arles indirectly benefited from this system too, what scholars call the Annona system. It made it so much easier, cheaper, and less risky for merchants to trade all across the Mediterranean. Obviously, not all the merchants trading around the region were subsidized, but the ones who were helped to keep costs lower and met a lot of the demand. So you, a merchant, bought wares from these subsidized ship captains who made their home port in Carthage. Some of these goods you'd sell locally in the pleasant towns and cities of nearby Provence. Maybe you'd go further, though, to upriver cities like Lyon and Vienne in central Gaul. Or maybe you'd go even further. Maybe you had a state contract to supply the cities and military bases of the Rhine frontier, hundreds of miles away. The first half of the 5th century was one of political breakdown all across the western half of the Roman Empire. When the barbarian Vandals captured the provinces of North Africa in the 430s, they broke the tax spine that had connected Italy to the region that supplied most of the grain that fed it. This also meant the end of state-subsidized shipping that had helped keep prices down for merchants like our friend in Arles. In the short term, this wasn't actually that bad. There was a brief economic slump in the 440s, but by the 450s, the Mediterranean economy was actually doing pretty well, even as the political structures of the Roman state fell apart. The end of the tax system may have even freed merchants and ship captains to make freer choices about where to buy and sell goods. Even without state support and subsidies, the major cities of the Mediterranean were still big enough to represent pockets of concentrated demand for goods. Infrastructure didn't decay overnight. As you, the merchant, slipped into old age around 450, you might not have noticed much of a difference from your youth in terms of doing day-to-day business. You didn't go to the Rhine frontier anymore, but you still bought olive oil, wine, and fine ceramics and sold them on to customers in Provence and upriver in Lyon. The pattern's straightforward. The bigger and more connected a city was into Mediterranean trade, the better it survived the end of the Roman state in the West. Arles, as the gateway to Gaul, survived pretty well into the 6th century. Its bishop was a big deal. He corresponded regularly with the Pope in Rome, and he led Gallic church councils. That helped to keep people in the city. Eventually, though, the economy did fall off. Without the state guaranteeing security, providing a baseline level of demand, and subsidizing shipping, trade in bulk goods died out. Ports silted up. Docks decayed. Roads weren't repaired. People left Arles for the countryside or died and weren't replaced by new migrants. By 600, perhaps 10,000 people still lived there. Back in 400, it had been 75 or 100,000. It took longer in some places than others. But everywhere, in what had been the western half of the Roman Empire, the characteristically Roman city declined and died out. Now, this general narrative of decline hides a ton of variation. While Dorchester on Thames and London were in trouble, Arles was still thriving. Those things aren't mutually exclusive. Even those narratives, prosperity and trouble, hide miniature booms and busts. Things might have been good for a few years, even a generation, and then gone downhill again. We should be wary of any attempt to generalize too much, and we have to be cognizant of how much the idea of decline can blind us to real, meaningful exceptions. But there's real value in the idea of a widespread, long-term decline. The fact that there was a ton of variation in region and time isn't in conflict with the idea of a general downward spiral. The historian J.H.W.G. Liebeschut sums it up best. Quote, "The story of the city in late antiquity involves the end of a political tradition, the end of a pattern of urban design related to the political tradition, the end of a particular ideal of what makes for a good life, the end of a secular ideal of education, and in many cases, the shrinking of population. All of this happened within a context of the collapsing structures of an empire and of the associated economic system. It abundantly deserves to be described as decline." Cities had defined what it meant to be Roman, how the empire functioned, and how its economy worked. As the empire fell apart, so did its cities, and so did Romanness itself. When Tides of History returns next month, we'll be heading 1,000 years into the future, to the rise of the modern world. We'll be talking about a subject I've been really excited to chat about, the late medieval economic explosion and the rise of capitalism. Banking, credit, a massive expansion of trade, reurbanization, and a whole new way of thinking about work and profit transformed the European and world economies in ways that still define us today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to talk about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History on Twitter. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the producer is Leah Sutherland. The executive producers are Ben Adair and Hernan Lopez. Thanks for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.